Welcome, friends, to the Grace Hour. Thanks so much for being with us. We're a daily program that takes a dive into the believer's daily challenges and helps him learn his faith in a practical way. My name is Pastor Jason Moore, and joining me today is Pastor John Hadley. And we're just so blessed to be with you on this great topic. It's been a great theme this week, and today we're going to lovingly in a compassionate way and in a clear way and hopefully based on people's capacity, we're gonna talk about how Christians can interact with people that have a same-sex attraction. And this can be a delicate topic, but just thinking about our confused culture, we can have a voice of spiritual reason. And I think, Pastor Hadley, we're just going to open this up with God's mind and God's thoughts. I mean, how can a Christian interact with someone with same-sex attraction?
Great question. I would like to answer that beginning in Mark chapter 7, because we can automatically feel like, okay, that's one of those taboo topics that I hope I never have to speak with someone on this area, because I just don't understand it. And I really wouldn't know what to say. So I think it helps to realize that our hearts are capable of any kind of activity imaginable, be it good or bad. And so Jesus addresses this question in Mark chapter 7 in verse 14. It says, "And he called the people to him again and said to them, 'Hear me, all of you, and understand.'" This is pretty basic what he's saying, but he has to make the point because they're not understanding. So he is speaking to give them understanding and give them the truth. "There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him, but the things that come out of a person are what defile him. And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, 'Then are you also without understanding?'" It's almost like Jesus is surprised, like, you can't comprehend this. It's so basic. "Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart but his stomach and is expelled? Thus he declared all foods clean. And he said, 'What comes out of a person is what defiles him.'" So then we come to this verse 21. This is the whole point here. "And from within, out of the heart of man," and then there's this long list of sins and things that defile a person. It's not from what goes into the person, it's from what's already present in the person. It's already there because of our fallen condition, because of the sin nature that we have inherited from Adam and Eve. They spiritually died and were disconnected from God, and likewise their children, and on through the successive generations. Here we are today. In that regard, nothing has changed, and Jesus is highlighting this fact. And so then he says, from within, out of the heart of man come evil thoughts. They're just there. They come out. And notice what's next after the evil thoughts: sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, sensuality is in there. All kinds of sins of the tongue. Verse 23, all these evil things come from within and they defile a person. So same-sex attraction is also out of the heart. It just, people are surprised by it. Why do I have these strange feelings and sensations about this person who's the same gender as I am? So that's not the sin. The evil heart is evil, but it could be that those sensations are, it's a mystery. Why am I having those? And so that is not necessarily the sin. The sin is what happens from that point. Because, you know, first of all, if it's not a believer, if the person hasn't been regenerated, then, you know, what are their options? It could be their conscience. I'm not going to follow through with my feelings because I know I've been taught that that's wrong. It's been wrong growing up in my family. Maybe they do go to church. Doesn't mean they're regenerated, etc. But the problem comes and the sin comes when those feelings are then, they become the person's identity. This is who I am. This is how I was born. I am acting out my feelings, and I have a relationship with someone else or other people of my same sex. So then that's homosexuality. So then for the believer, okay, that's a problem right there. That's a sin. So the person needs to understand that. And so it's back to the Bible. It's the scriptures. It's what does God think about that? Does God have anything to say about it? And so, you know, then it becomes a Bible study.
Mm.
And if the person is regenerated, then we would hope that they would humbly respond and repent of that activity and receive grace and support to abandon that sin like any other sin.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't like it's the worst sin in the Bible, but it is a sin, like gossip, like covetousness, like lying. Yes.
Yeah, I think a lot of the Christian world can, there's a lot of accusation from the world saying that there's really, you know, there's this old fashioned or this narrow view that really the expression of someone's desire, you know, to be happy. So therefore fill in the blank, whatever makes you happy, you know, and it's like, you know, all we want to do is be happy. And why resist the way we were made? Or maybe they would say, this is my unique expression. And I think like we are predisposed to certain things because of our old heart, right? There's this fallen nature that cleaves to the dust, as we know in Psalm 119:25, that animal nature that without truth, we would follow the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. That's, we gravitate to these things. But our predisposition doesn't have to be our predetermination, which means how I was, or how we, I should say, is how we're wired doesn't necessarily mean it has to define our life. So when you think about the old heart, you know, morality tends to be the main objective. But in the believer's mind and purpose, it's really spirituality. So when you meet someone, I would say one of the key point is compassion, but not the kind of compassion that's like consenting or like trying to make that person feel good about their sin. But there's compassion, but then there's clarity, like you're bringing up, what is God's mind about this? Do you want to know God's mind about this? And really, you could even say, if the person confesses to be a believer and their actions are opposite of what the Bible teaches, they've changed the truth of God into a lie to feed their own lust pattern, then is there guilt? Is there shame? Is there like some challenge from the Spirit in their life? And I know thinking about this predisposition, like the person that maybe you know, maybe they have alcohol in their family, and now when they go into a situation where there's alcohol, the propensity or the desire is to drink alcohol. There's like we're wired that way, or we are attracted, or there's a desire to fulfill our lusts. But I think it doesn't have to be our predetermination. It doesn't have to be the way the story goes, right?
Yeah, like preconditioned.
Mm-hmm.
From environment, from friends, from family history, all those things. But Yeah, to go back to the point, if the person is not a true believer, then that can be an evangelistic opportunity, like you were telling me about the knocking on the door and having the gay flag out there and explaining the colors, which is a great way to, great segue to, you know, talk about, you know, the real heart issue. But for believers, someone who has the same sex attraction, I suppose most people don't talk about it. But the line is, do I cast that down, that imagination, that thought, and do I bring it into captivity of Christ, or do I start putting wood on the wrong fire? And then, you know, which would lead to sin and discipline and just a confused life with regret and spiritual setback. Not that God can't redeem all that, but why go that way if you don't have to?
Mm. Yeah, it's a very destructive lifestyle, and I think if you make it a hard issue that, you know, people can say, you know, it's not a gender issue, it's a sexual orientation. You know, they're all about my feeling, my expression, therefore defines my reality. Where you know, that's why the absurdity of, let's say, a male going into a girl's bathroom because he feels like a female. We look at these things and say, oh my gosh, how could that be? But I think we read about it in Ephesians 4, 17 through 19. There's the futility of the mind. And then later on, we see in 1 Timothy 4, 2, there's a searing of the conscience where now good is called evil and evil is called good. So there's compassion, but our compassion leads to clarity. Like let's look at the end of this. Are you really, you know, is it really something that is not only making you happy, but is it their normal, their new normal, we should say, is very different than reality? And it's almost like walking them through the Bible and not condemning them, right? John 3:17, we're not there to condemn, but the Holy Spirit instructs, and if they are saved, then there's that understanding you read about in Mark 9. Now, I know you and I talked about a very interesting word. It's called expressive individualism, right?
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones.
Yeah, do you want to talk about that? That was such an interesting point. I think it defines our culture.
Yes. As someone has said, I'd give him credit, but I can't remember his name. That we live in such a therapeutic culture in society that we're so given over to and focused on how we feel about things. And so if something you say makes me feel bad, then I'm offended and it must be wrong. But that's not the way God deals with us. There are many things that make us feel bad, and God intends that they make us feel bad, so that we will turn away from them. Yeah, it's like the time of the judges where everyone did that which was right in his own eyes. And for sure, we're living in those times, you know, as they say, on steroids. Just a kind of an aside here, I wrote down Deuteronomy 28:15, and it is the section in the Pentateuch that talks about the blessings and the cursings. And this is the cursing section. And it says here, God says, if you disobey my commandments and ignore my statutes, if you just basically give me your back and don't care much about what I have to say, or what I have said, actually, we can say, notice what will happen. If Israel will not obey God's voice and do his commandments and statutes that he commands, then all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. And so he starts to list them, and then he comes to verse 20. We come to verse 20. The Lord will send upon you curses. And then he says, confusion. is the first word. Confusion and frustration and all you set your heart to do. So then somehow he's talking about the nation of Israel, but all of a sudden confusion comes into their society. And then it gets worse as they continue in their disobedience in verse 28. The Lord will strike you with madness. And then he says, the Hebrew is to rage with insanity. It means craziness and madness. Isn't that amazing? So we're living in a society where basically people have been struck with madness. In other words, their thinking is confused. They arrive at wrong conclusions. And as a result, everyone is doing that which is right in their own eyes. So, we're looking for answers to address all this madness, but actually it's kind of way beyond us, because what we see and what we're living is the fruit of people in a society have turned their backs upon God. Mm-hmm. They don't want him, don't like him, don't think they don't need him. And as a result, it's like Romans, that God is giving people up, giving them over to what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And because those restraints aren't there anymore, like they once were, now we're dealing with this mess of confusion.
Mm.
Interesting, isn't it?
It is. I think, again, when the more we move away from the Bible, the more man is at the center and the inconsistencies. And man, our default is brokenness. That's our default. And so I think our desires, like Acts 13:10 says that the devil's main objective is to pervert righteousness. So if we're given over to madness, it's because we have left the truth, and therefore we are now setting up the truth, or we are now defining truth. I mean, we're in a very sexualized culture, like unbelievably, where it's all about you, it's all about your desire, it's all about your craving, it's all your inordinate appetite. Like, you can have it all, and you're not affecting anybody. It's just you and your cyclical storm, if I could say, where there's no satisfaction. And I guess that might be a good question to ask. Let's say the person is believer, unbeliever, but are you satisfied in the lifestyle that you have? I mean, is there, like, and be honest, like, is there satisfaction in your lifestyle, in your life? We asked one missionary one time that was very legalistic. We just said to him, are you happy? Are you, like, enjoying God in your relationship? And you could tell their body language said everything opposite of what they were saying out loud. They were saying, oh, yeah, of course I am. But their body language was very different. And I think if there's honesty, right, the man or the woman, as Proverbs says, that's addicted to pleasure is dead while they still live. I think, again, there's compassion, clarity, but then the capacity is, let's think about you. Think about how God made you. Let's think about the truth that sets you free. Are you free? You know, like trans lifestyle, right? Men and women of the same gender adopting kids, raising kids in this environment. The gender confusion, the sexual crisis, because people have graduated away from the Bible. They're like, I'm just going to follow my own way, and it leads to madness, right? I think what we're seeing is madness, right?
Yeah, yes. Like our, we could say the wheels are coming off the wagon,
mm-hmm.
And where is this going to end up? It's not going to end well, because it is contrary to God's plan, and I think it's the devil working, and it goes back to the original question in the Garden of Eden. Has God said? You just push back on what God has said. Has God said? And number two, don't you know that you can be your own God? You don't need him. God's holding back on you, and you can live your way. and this is what people are doing. And so I think we each either have family members or know people who are dealing with this in their close families, same-sex relationships, or gender dysphoria, all these things. And the parents are at their wits' end trying to figure out, well, Christian parents, like, well, how do I deal with this? And, you know, it can be a real trial. And, of course, parents are brokenhearted. Like, how could this be that I brought up my son or my daughter in Sunday school since they were old enough to walk and went through Christian school and et cetera, et cetera, and now they're living this way?
Mm. I think a good point to kind of maybe say to that, Pastor, is that always keep the lines of communication open. Don't, like, reject them and cut off all ties. In this regard, like, if it's a family member, you want to have the compassion there. But I remember people asking me, like, okay, I have a family member. They want to bring their partner in. They want to stay overnight because they're visiting from another part of the country. And it's like, wait a minute. Like, we can love, but the boundaries of our home are very sacred. And there should be a boundary of sacredness and holiness not to allow perversion to come into our homes, right?
Yes.
And like Psalm 101 talks about living perfectly before God in our homes. I mean, think about that for a minute. I mean, it's these sexual struggles. I think people sexually struggle because they are absent of a real connection, a real authentic connection. And so our message is not condemnation. Our message isn't like, live like the devil and you're going to be okay. But really it's, okay, we all have unique expressions, but they must mirror the image in which we were created in Genesis 1:26. So my message to someone is not, you know, you're such a wicked sinner, what's wrong with you? My message is you were made in a different image. You were made in holiness in Ephesians 4:24. And really, I think in our clarity and compassionate message, and not, we're not condoning. We're not saying it's okay. You know, you live your life the way you feel is right, like individual expressionism, where your truth is based on what you feel and what you express is your reality. But no, there's a higher reality where it's the reality of God. And then I think living that out, right? Living that out in a compassionate way and, you know, saying, I love you, right? That cliche, love the sinner, hate the sin. I'm almost careful how I say it. It's like, I love you. You mean more to me, but your sin is breaking the heart of God. It is. It's breaking the heart of God. So, I mean, that kind of takes it beyond where we're going today. I mean, same sex. I think what you said on the onset, like, just because there's an attraction, it doesn't mean it's sin. It's how you act on it that makes it either. I think that's an important point to repeat, yeah.
Yeah. So the question is, so how can we help people? Someone who wants help. Mm. Someone who doesn't want help, okay, they don't want help, at least for now. But what's going to help a person? We can read the verses. We could talk about put off the old, put on the new, make no provision for the flesh. We're dead with Christ. We're crucified with him. All those are truths and they're factual. But sometimes it's just words. Like, where's the power? Mm-hmm. Where's the deliverance? Where's the change? I need help. Help me. I would like to recommend this beautiful provision that God has given to us that we could pray. Maybe instead of praying, Lord, you know, change my feelings, change my attitude, pray, change my desires. Maybe we could pray, Lord, teach me to fear you. Teach me the fear of the Lord. Because Proverbs 1:7 says, The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. The fools despise wisdom and instruction. So that knowledge is really the knowledge of God. Hmm. That the fear of the Lord is the beginning of really knowing Him and His holiness and His hatred for sin and all those verses that are kind of shocking. I think we need the Bible as good shock therapy. If we really study those scriptures,
yeah.
we will have shock and awe at the holiness of God. And I think that may be the most important, the crucial element of deliverance. If someone could pray by faith, though they feel so far away from it, Lord, show me the fear of the Lord, because the fear of the Lord would drive me away from anything that is unholy and displeasing to you. I think that's the crux of the matter right there. And that's not for the homosexual alone or the one who is battling same-sex attraction. That is for all of us in whatever thing. I'm unloving toward my wife. I'm reactionary toward my wife. Whatever it is that the Holy Spirit, gives us an elbow about, that's not right. That's not of me. Whatever it might be, but to love righteousness and hate iniquity. Mm. So that's across the board. And I think if we are moved by the fear of the Lord and the holiness of God, I think that will that meets all of us where we are and burns up the chaff. It's like, in the light of your holiness, I don't want anything that is offensive to you, God. All of a sudden, my desires for the forbidden have totally evaporated because I see your fiery holiness and that you are still a consuming fire. And if I live this way, this one day I'm going to have to give account for my life. And am I ready to die right now? I am not ready to die right now. With fear and trembling, Lord, I would dread standing before you the way I'm living right now. So saying that that's an inevitable day for both the lost and the saved, it makes perfect sense to employ the fear of the Lord to get these stubborn issues dealt with. I think that's a huge provision that God has given to us.
A verse comes to my mind, Psalm 86:11, unite my heart to fear your name. Like, unite my heart, like bring into this engrafted knitting of truth that causes me and you and all of us to honor you, to reverence you. Because that's a powerful thought. One day we will stand before God and give an account, and we know that when we stand before God, sin won't be the environment of that meeting, right? It'll be the Bema seat will be a judgment seat, Romans 12:10, of opportunities and things that we did in really walking with God and missing opportunities. And this can be a glorious time, and this can also be a time where of great loss, right? But in 1 Corinthians 3, it talks about that fire that burns up the wood, hay, and stubble. And so fearing the Lord, I think, is one of those, we see that in Proverbs 6 and 7, to have an understanding that where does my sin, where does it take me? It's going to take me, in Proverbs 6, to the gate, to the hell, actually. The harlot will take us right down to the gate of hell. But when we're, again, not that we fear that person into reality, but I think when you say a lot of people feel like they're prisoners, they have these thoughts and maybe they've acted on them and maybe they're not, but it wears them down. And it's like, but the fear of the Lord, right, is something that makes the man clean, right? It renews the mind. It brings in. So, because here's one of the greatest lies, and we've heard it, God will not meet my greatest need. I have to go out and do it. Mm-hmm. Or if people knew who I really was, they'd want nothing to do with me. Like the devil projects, you have to help God because God is not faithful. So there's this attraction, this desire. If it could be overeating, it could be gambling, it could be pornography, it could be, many things. But we then try to manage our sin, and then it becomes something. It becomes like chaotic, and then all of a sudden, the person may just give up. And God is saying, "No, just come to me, surrender." And I love that. Just instead of "Lord, change me, help me to stop do this." No. Lord, bring in your fear, right? Bring in your wisdom. And the outcome of those things will produce the action of righteousness or the action of sobriety or the action of cleanliness, right? Godliness, right?
Yes.
There's a lot to that thought.
Yeah. I like what you said. Hosea 9:7 says, "The days of punishment have come. The days of recompense have come. Israel shall know it. The prophet is a fool. The man of the spirit is mad because of the great iniquity and great hatred." And then it basically says the same thing in Jeremiah, but it says that the people love to have it so. It's like people love their sin.
Yeah.
But that's where the fear of the Lord, when we think back of what's happened through history, whether it's the Reformation, whether it's the Puritan era, whether it's the First Great Awakening in Europe and America, or the Second Great Awakening, there's one theme that the preachers, that was central to their preaching, and that caused people to turn their lives over to God. I mean, they were so anxious in the negative sense about their life before God. Some of the times Jonathan Edwards preached, he had to stop preaching because they couldn't hear him anymore because the sobs and the crying were so loud that he had to let that take its course.
Wow.
But it happened through preaching the fear of the Lord. I just know that when Isaiah saw the holiness of God, we know this, he said, "I'm a dead man." And then what did he confess but the truth about himself? He goes, what comes out of these lips, I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Which came out of his heart. He said, "Not in this whole nation and me." And it's interesting that once that brokenness comes and once that admission comes, then the cleansing comes. Because it was immediately the angel went and took the coal off of the altar and touched his lips with it and changed him. And this is the way it is. When even Peter, James, and John heard the voice from heaven, "This is my beloved son, hear him." It says they hit the ground, and it said they were sore afraid. These guys were trembling because of the voice they heard.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the way it's so easy to kind of trifle with God and to take him so lightly, which is so dangerous, because God is who he is. And it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God, because he's still a living fire. But once that happens, it's when the grace of God pours out upon us and the love of God overwhelms us and the mercy of God is just so much a part of our life. But that transition period, if it's just taken lightly, then so often the response is a light response.
Yeah.
Like Coke Light, we got Christianity Light. Because people have not been confronted by the fear of the Lord. And I think that's what's needed across the board.
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it well. I think we can trifle or minimize or say, oh, it's not a big deal, everyone's doing it, or there can be this perversion that we allow, that flirtation that is learned, like all behaviors learned. So we see that if we allow flirtation with the world, we're going to learn the world. We're going to learn to think like the world. I mean, one writer says our understanding is now why we are where we are today. Like if our understanding is compromised, then we are far from the fear of the Lord. But I think there's a great hope that we can encourage someone that they can come and have someone that they can be honest with, that they can pray with, that they can be encouraged to cast down those imaginations, to identify what is truth and what is emotion, right? Like this idea of expression, you know, you see people with these all kinds of expressions, like from piercing to tattoos to coloring of hair, and all that is what it is. But inside, there's the cry of the heart, like, am I valuable? Am I someone that is significant? Does anybody really know me? And I think when they're overwhelmed with the grace and the mercy and the truth, then their sin, that cyclical disaster, it never satisfies the soul. It never satisfies. Okay, same-sex attraction, okay, you get that relationship, right? And then all of a sudden, it's death, right? It's death. It's like not, because I think that's what lust and temptation does. They, and fantasy, they portray this amazing reality of what will be, and they, it's like you deserve it, and this. But when you get there, it's hollow. It's, there's nothing there. Where the fear of the Lord is, it's clean, it's contentment, there's purpose, clarity. And I think in a compassionate way, we can explain or share or demonstrate through personal testimony or otherwise that really what you're really looking for is not found in this twisted thought, but in Christ, in the Bible, and in the fear of the Lord. And so I think now with our society, it's always been dark, but I mean, now it's like so blatant. I think this kind of teaching is almost like it's foreign. It's foreign to people where, you know, do what feels right. Follow your heart. You know, just if you want that, go for it. You deserve it. You work hard or whatever. Whatever. It, but no, the fear of the Lord is I'm not the center. Christ is the center. The fear of the Lord is my inordinate desire that I cannot or we cannot defeat. God can defeat it by giving us a new purpose, a new heart, living in the new heart. It's that's why a church is important. That's why godly friends are important. That's why identifying different influences in our life. Am I making an impact or am I being impacted? I think worldliness can lead us down any path, and it's surprising where we can end up if it's unchecked, you know?
Yeah, the body of Christ is super important, so central to have godly friends. And sin, of course, pulls us away from that, and that's pretty much how it works. We start drawing near, we are edified, we are nurtured, we are strengthened, our convictions are deepened, and we're making spiritual progress. I have this this article here, and I didn't know if it's probably good just to answer the question about, you know, where does the evangelical church stand, the conservative evangelical church? This was, it's called the Nashville Statement, a Coalition for Biblical Sexuality. And a whole bunch of big name evangelicals signed on to this. I would just like to maybe read a couple of them because there are some affirmations and then denials regarding different issues in sexuality. For example, it says, we affirm that God has designed marriage to be a covenantal, sexual, procreative, lifelong union of one man and one woman as husband and wife, and is meant to signify the covenant love between Christ and his bride, the church. That's a good succinct definition, very biblical. We deny that God has designed marriage to be a homosexual, polygamous, polyamorous relationship. We also deny that marriage is a mere human contract rather than a covenant made before God. So actually this paper, they came up with 14 articles, and I think they're all spot on. Maybe I can read a couple more.
Sure.
We affirm that God's revealed will for all people is chastity outside of marriage and fidelity within marriage. Right? I think, let me repeat that because that one's good. Some people go berserk over this. We affirm that God's revealed will for all people is chastity outside of marriage, meaning no sex if you're not married, and fidelity within marriage. One man, one woman, one husband, one wife. That's it. We deny that any affections, desires, or commitments ever justify sexual intercourse before or outside marriage, nor do they justify any form of sexual immorality. Those are good, straightforward, highlighted truths categorized from the Bible. We affirm that God created Adam and Eve, the first human beings, in his own image, equal before God as persons and distinct as male and female. We affirm that. We deny that the divinely ordained differences between male and female render them unequal in dignity or worth.
Mm.
Great stuff. I don't know how much time we have. I just really like these.
That's excellent. And that's clarity. See, that brings in clarity and cuts through the confusion. Like, what does God think? Therefore, that's what's going to bring in the fear of the Lord and offset what we think, what we feel. All right? We're such a feeling society.
Yes.
Right?
I got a couple more.
Please.
This one in particular, Article 8. We affirm that people who experience sexual attraction for the same sex may live a rich and fruitful life, pleasing to God through faith in Jesus Christ, like all Christians, walking in purity of life. So it means there's an attraction, but it's not an identity, and it's not lived out, but it's a temptation. We deny that sexual attraction for the same sex is part of the natural goodness of God's original creation, and that it puts a person outside the hope of the gospel. So if this is something that's consistent temptation for the person, it doesn't put them outside the hope of the gospel, like it says here. So there's hope for them, and as it says in Article 9, we affirm that sin distorts sexual desires by directing them away from the marriage covenant and towards sexual immorality, a distortion that includes both heterosexual and homosexual immorality because of sin. We deny that an enduring pattern of desire for sexual immorality justifies sexual immoral behavior. So just because the desire is there, the attraction is there, the urge is there, it in no ways justifies living that way. So just some of the points here. But if you're interested in this, you can Google Nashville Statement, and then you can read them all for yourself. But they did a very good job. It even has a list of at least some of those who signed on to it. I think it's healthy, and it helps people know where the boundary lines are.
Yeah, and I think it's good for the church to be talking about these things from a biblical perspective. There's no taboo subjects. Again, I just think that if someone is struggling, that they can come talk to someone that the Lord leads them to, that can lead them and give them a biblical perspective like we just read. And then the Lord will unite your heart. He will bring in the desire. He will bring in the hunger. He'll bring in the passion to follow him and to take up our cross, which is really to lift up what God has done and to deny ourselves, because that can't happen unless I'm focused on what God has done, because that nature is not something that can be managed, but it needs to be laid at the cross. And God says, okay, I'm going to resurrect your new nature. And maybe as I close, Pastor, we talk a lot about the Christian. I mean, the unbeliever, really, it's a process as well. I mean, we're compassionate, loving, not condemning, but we're clear. And we're addressing them according to their capacity. And they'll see your life of stability. They'll see your life of, let's say, contentment. And they'll say, okay, that's real. That's real. I'm chasing after something that makes me more hungry, right? Or more dissatisfied or more fearful or more shameful. But the believer really is a trophy of grace that is declaring the goodness of God, declaring the reality of God. And that's where healing comes in. And I know we have to close, but I think when we deal with homosexuality, lesbianism, all of these alternative lifestyles, emotional trauma is all webbed and connected to these things, where maybe there was an abusive father, an overbearing mother, or just an abuse of some sort that God wants to deliver a person so that they can live a life without torment, right? There's no fear in love. That torment can be removed, and their values, significance, and love and care from the Spirit can really heal a person. So these are real issues that need attention and a Bible-based approach, like Psalm 107:20. He sent the word and it healed them from all their diseases and their destructions, right? Their internal destructions, right? So we have an amazing opportunity and privilege to love people where they're at, right? To love them, but our love has truth. And our truth is not a hammer, but it's an open hand that says, this is God's mind. Come and learn and be transformed, right? Any last thoughts? Yes. Any last words here?
Yeah, just I like that word love, because Jesus said the greatest commandment, the greatest, number one, the highest, the most important, is to love God. And, you know, what's hidden in there? Like, if that's the greatest commandment, then to disregard it would do the greatest damage. So by God's grace, he will help us to love him, and from loving him comes loving other people. And when we're living a life of loving God and loving people, we are on the right track. We will be delivered from many unnecessary trials and snares. And it starts with the fear of the Lord.
Yeah. And then he fills our cup, right? And then there's real satisfaction, right?
Yes.
It's incredible.
Yes.
Well, friends, thanks for joining us today. And we really love to hear from you here at the Grace Hour. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify, and much, much more. We, again, join us for our next show upcoming here every day at 11 o'clock. God bless you.